Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody out there with Nation Billing. I'm glad you guys came in tonight. We're going to have an awesome night. We got Brother Dennis Muhammad on the phone, Captain Brother Dennis Muhammad, and Sister Gidget on the phone, man. Everybody else, they just hung up because they don't know it's a Blog Talk show, evidently, so they hung up on me. But we're going to get everybody back on the phone. We're going to get this show on the way. Hey, Sister Gidget, man, you need to let these people know, man. They don't understand how the show works. We need to let them know, man, so they can stop hanging up. One guy was on the phone screaming, hello, 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 and the woman, she was like, hello, and she hung up. So we need to get that in order, man, because, you know, we got to get that in order pretty quick.
Usually they're on before the prelude of the music, so since we have some technical difficulties tonight, they probably didn't understand. They wasn't prepared for that. Neither were we. So.
Yeah, but we're not having no difficulties like that, sister. We this show will go on, and it's going on right now, but I don't know, man. I don't know. Hey, I'm going to call up Brother Jihad one more time. See if we can get him on the phone. Hey, Brother Dennis, are you out there?
Yes, sir. I'm on. Thank you.
Dennis, what's up, man? How you doing, brother?
Yes.
Fine, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great, man. Everybody else there, I guess they're doing good, but I got to get them back on the phone, man. I don't know what's up, but I'm trying right now.
Yes, sir.
So we get them on the phone. It's going away, man. Hey, thanks for not hanging up, brother. Thank you for not hanging up.
Yes. What's gonna happen if my phone hang up?
Brother keeps saying yes. Who's that keeps saying yes?
It's Brother Jihad, sir.
Okay, thank you. We hear you, Brother Jihad. Please, we hear you, brother. We know you're alive.
Okay.
Thank you, Brother Cat.
Okay, we have another lady that's supposed to be on it. Please, Nation Building family and the audience, please forgive us. We're having some technical problems here, but we're going to carry on like we always carry on. And I'm going to give Caesar 1 minute to kind of get Ms. D back on the phone if he can.
Yeah. Hopefully she'll pick up.
Hello?
Hi, Ms. D, this is Sister Gidget from Nation Hi. Building on Blog Talk Radio. You live on the air. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Tonight.
Wonderful.
Ooh, okay.
Hey, Sister Gidget, hold on one second. Let me tell you how the show works, first of all. If you got a question out there in the audience, just press 1 on your keypad. I'll see that. You have a question mark pop up by your area code. Like I got area code 678 right now. If 678 push 1 on your keypad, that will let me know you got a question. I'll call it out your area code, and then you can ask your question or make a comment. If anybody out there wants to make a comment, let's wait towards these guys get done talking, and we'll have that like a little bit later on. But if you got any questions, hold on to your questions right quick. Brother Dennis, he's going to talk to you guys. Sister Gidget and Sister Steve's going to talk to you guys. And we also have Brother Jihad. He's going to be talking also. So everybody just sit back and enjoy the show tonight. And the way the show's going to start from now on, folks that don't know, everybody's going to small right now, please hear my voice once and for all. When you come on the phone, you hear the music playing, that's just the music playing. You guys have to hang up the phone because I got to call you back, and you guys, you know, you're holding me up. So let's hold on to the phone calls. Let's not hang up. Let's stay on the phone. Everybody's on the phone right now, including Sister Gidget. Stay on the phone. Brother Dennis, stay on the phone. We got you, brother. We got all of you. Hey, guys, what's up? Let's get the show started, Sister Gidget.
Assalamu alaikum, audience. Like I said, I apologize for all the technical difficulties tonight. Thank you, DJ Black Caesar. I want to say again, assalamu alaikum to my distinguished panel and greetings to everyone. And thank you once again for joining us on Nation Building. We're going to get right into it because I don't know what's going to happen next. Tonight we have Brother Captain Dennis Muhammad back with us with the Peacekeepers Initiative. Assalamu alaikum to you, sir. How are you?
Well, alaikum salam, sister. I'm fine. Thanking Allah much.
Well, that voice doesn't sound too much better. How are you feeling?
Oh, I feel great, sister. I'm doing all right.
Yes, sir. Okay, and we have Ms. D all the way from Richmond, California. Ms. D, how are you this evening?
I'm doing great.
And thank you for joining us, because this is her first time on our show, but I'm sure it's not her last. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Jihad.
Wa alaikum salam, beloved. How are you?
I'm blessed by Allah's grace, even though my hat just turned 4 shades whiter. It's all right. We here. Okay, I wanted to start with Brother Dennis. And Brother Dennis, as you know, we talked about your peace initiative last week. We talked about some of the things that's going on in the community to implement that initiative. But I wanted to kind of go to the root of peace itself, if you don't mind. And so my first question to you would be, where do those who are seeking peace, regardless of their class or their circumstances, where do we begin to find peace? Because I'm a true believer that in order for us to have peace in our community, that peace has to begin somewhere, and it has to begin within each individual. And oftentimes we have so many things that is that are disruptive to our lives and that, you know, we don't handle well. So how do we first generate that peace within ourselves?
Well, sister, first and foremost, giving honor and praise to God who's the head of my life, I thank Allah much for giving me another chance that I may have correct yesterday's mistake.
He's on.
Yes. Can you hear me?
If you're not talking right now, please mute your phone.
So
yes, sir. Go ahead, Brother Kef. I'm sorry.
So to answer a very great question, because there's no way that we can seek peace in our community if we don't have peace of mind. And the true peace that we all seek has to be rooted in our submission to do the will of God. I'm not confused on that. Many people say, well, before we can have peace in our community, we have to have peace with God. I totally, totally agree with anyone who makes that statement. And that's why the religion that we, the Muslims, believe in is called Islam. Islam means peace and submission to the will of God. It ain't truly until one submits his or her will to God's will that we find peace in our life. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that the first law of God was the law of motion, and the second law of God was the law of order. One of the things that we all can bear witness is that our community is out of order. Our homes are out of order. Our children are out of order. When something is out of order, it's out of harmony. When something is out of order, it's out of position. And when you find something 9 times out of 10 that's out of order, you would find a sign on it saying that this is broke, it's non-functioning, and it's not working. Well, that's the way our community is. That's the way our homes are. We find our homes out of order because we're not in harmony, submitting ourselves to do the will of God. So to answer your question, dear sister, when we begin to start living a life and striving to do what's right and to do what's right, we begin our journey to live a life of order. And in that order, you have harmony. In that harmony, you will find peace. So that as soon as we get our life in order, and in order for us to be in order, we have to make up our minds. Do we want life or do we want death? So in order for us to have peace, we have to accept one of those two variables. Do you want life? If you want life, then you have to seek God because he's the author of life. If we want death, then choose this world because that's exactly what you get when you transgress the law of God. When you go against the law of God, he promised Adam and Eve that when they transgress in the garden, and transgression only means disobeying the law of God, you get death. So we're looking at death in our homes. We see death in our communities. We see death every day because you see a people that have transgressed the law of God. So as soon as we get back in harmony with God, as soon as we desire to do what's right, then God guarantees us order in our life, and that order subsequently brings us peace. I hope I answered that question, sister.
Absolutely. Absolutely, sir. And I so much agree with you. But as we look at the teenagers today, I call them teenagers, but sometimes it begins even younger than that. Our younger men and women, the adolescents of our community, there appears to be so much anger already in them. So speak to them, Brother Captain Dennis. How can we channel that energy that they're putting into that anger into a more positive way of expressing themselves besides joining gangs or, you know, having sexual overtones or experiencing in drugs and alcohol? How can we re-channel that anger that is within them, and what is the cause of it?
Well, you know, sister, there's so many things that we could speak to. There's many people who are listening, who many people that would like to add into what they believe causes the anger. But I remember listening to one of our scholars, Dr. Omar Johnson. He made a very valid point. And his point is, if you take away a people's pride, you kill their will to strive to change their condition. What we're looking at in our young people is they don't have nothing to be proud of anymore. And when you see a people that has no pride, you see a people that have no will to change their condition. It was the pride of the slaves, their pride of where they came from, that kept them striving to change their condition. You couldn't break the pride. Remember the movie Roots, when we seen the man break the pride or break the will of Kunta Kinte, who wanted to make, they wanted to make him Toby. Well, you know, we don't, our young people have nothing to be proud of anymore. If you go in the streets, they don't hold their head up high. They hold their head down. Well, what is it that we have given them as adults? What has we as grown adults, what we have done as men, what have we given our children to be proud of? We pass on to our children debt, while other people pass on to their children wealth. What have we given our children that they can look forward to the future of tomorrow? We haven't given them nothing, so they look for other things to make themselves feel important. In the great book that I read constantly, is called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, he says these words: people do best that makes them feel important. You want to see people do the best that they could do? Give them something that makes them feel important. And one of the things about the word important is that people crave it. We all crave importance. But what do we have for our young people to make them feel important? So they join the gangs because being in a gang makes them feel important. They begin to get involved in certain things that brings attention to them that makes them feel important. A drug dealer, he feels important when a crackhead can come to him 3 o'clock in the morning and beg him for drugs. It makes him feel important. It makes a person feel important where they can strike fear in someone when they see them because they're wearing a certain gang color or throwing a certain gang sign. So our young people want to feel important. But what have we given them? They don't feel important, but they feel important that they can go out here and start speaking a language that would get them attention. No matter how degrading the language is, it makes them feel important that they can speak that language. So we are seeing a generation of young people who are angry because we as adults, in my humble opinion, have not provided them the kind of environment that is conducive to life. We are the only people, sister, that we live in an environment that is not conducive to life. Every human being creates an environment that is conducive to life. You look at the Amish people. The Amish people live in an environment that is conducive to life. It's conducive to their practice. It's conducive to their religion. It's conducive to their way of life. If you went to Utah, when they had the movie Brokeback Mountain, it was not shown in Utah among the Mormons because the Mormons would not display such a movie that was not conducive to their practice or their religion or was not conducive to their way of life. Look at our community. Our community is not conducive to life. It's conducive to death. We have failed. We have failed to provide an environment that would allow our children to grow up free of child molestation, free of drugs, free of crime, and free of violence. We have failed. And because of that failure as adults to provide the environment for our women to raise up their children in that kind of environment, this is what we get. We get an angry generation of youth that has no respect for life. And this is the price we pay. We, the Muslims, are taught, what is the duty of the civilized man? And the answer is to teach the uncivilized cultural refinement. And if the civilized man failed to perform his duty, what must be done? And the answer says he is or she is to be punished severely. Well, we have almost have done that. We have failed to civilize our people from their savage ways. And look at our generation of youth, and we're paying a price for it. So if we want to take the anger look off our young people's face, then we as adults must stop trying to judge them. We as adults must stop trying to talk down to them and talk up to them. And if we go into the communities and show love to our young people, for Jesus says, with love and kindness I draw thee. I believe that if we show love to our young people, we would draw them to a better way of life. We as adults must be better in how we raise our children. We must give them a life that would allow them to have something they can be proud of, something that holds their heads up high. And so far, we have failed to give them that kind of lifestyle.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And with that being said, Brother Captain, I want to introduce Miss D. Miss D is, I don't know what's your title, but she works with the youth in Richmond, California, where there have been an astronomical amount of murders of young people in that community. Miss D, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, can you introduce yourself and let us know what it is that you're doing in Richmond and tell us about what is going on with the younger generation in Richmond and, you know, what is the cause of everything that's been going on there? Because, you know, we don't hear about Richmond too much. So enlighten us. What's going on?
Oh, my name is Ms. D, and I'm from Richmond, California. And I am a volunteer with CISCO. We're a Contra Costa Interfaith Supporting Community Organization. And our organization is practicing the ceasefire model in Richmond. And over the past few years, there was a documentary that came out called The Interrupters that brought a message that we can end violence, and violence is starting to be decreased in over 100 cities throughout the United States, including Chicago, Baltimore, and in the California area, Stockton, California, Oakland, California, and also Richmond, California. What the two gentlemen spoke about is absolutely true, and I definitely agree with them. And we know the end result, which we're living today, but we have to get past looking at the result of how we got here and get solution-based. So CISCO, ceasefire, we look at the gun violence as a form of a disease, that has overcome our city. And we work with experts and professionals and clergymen and community persons to go out and talk to the people on the streets and meet them right where they are.
So tell us about, you know, what started this initiative. What was actually going on in Richmond that this was a necessity?
The street violence, the killings, the murders, there were maybe five particular groups of people that were committing these crimes and holding the city hostage, where we weren't able to move about freely for fear of our lives and our children's lives. And the reports and the statistics were saying that our based on our population, we were our population is not that big, so we were in the despair of losing all our young people based on this, the killings. We had over 150 killings, like in a year's period of time. They were up 150%, and this was in the 98-99 reports on our statistics. So what started the outreach were that people just started to get tired. And we found a solution that was working to bring the community, to empower the community to go out and talk to the young people that are committing the crimes.
So has there been a dramatic change since the your program was started?
Since we started a year ago, there's been a 50% decrease in gun violence. The arrest for gun charges has decreased. The police department is also a part of this initiative, and we have people that come sit at the table. We call ourselves a working group. So we meet with probation, the city police, social workers, and other community-based organizations. And also we have Office of Neighborhood Safety, which are peacekeepers in our community that we meet also and strategize on ways we can address the violence and the young men and women, because there are young women out there shooting too, that we can help them to turn that into a positive. So when we have these meetings, we strategize on our plans, and the ceasefire component goes and meets with church organizations throughout the community, and we gather as many community members as possible to go out into the community every week to walk the neighborhoods that are the highest crime rate areas. And our presence in those communities helps to keep the violence down. And then we engage with the perpetrators of violence in individual face-to-face meetings. About once a month we do what's called call-in, and we have the men and women that are on probation who are known to be a shooter or likely to be shot. We have them come into the room. We have law enforcement come in and explain to them the consequences of their actions and the jail terms that can go along with being caught with a gun or using a gun in a violent act. We've had a 50% decrease in gun violence in the last year.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that with us, Ms. D. So, you know, I had Brother Minister Robert, Southwest Regional Student Representative for the Nation of Islam, on Sunday. And as always, he said something that was very profound to me. He says that when it comes to politics, we are always saying that, you know, our politicians are not accountable. And then he asked me, he said, well, what did we ask them for? And he said that the black community in particular does not have an agenda. So, Brother Captain Dennis, I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to ask you, is there a black and brown peace agenda?
Well, you know, it was. I hear what my sister said tonight, and I tip my hat off to the ceasefire model. It has seemed to be a model that's being adapted in many cities. It came out of the Chicago, and I have much respect for the interrupters. It's also a part of a comprehensive plan. No one initiative is absolutely doing this by themselves. It has to be a joint effort, as she mentioned, with many of the stakeholders in the community. And, of course, it has to have the support of the people in the community as well as be backed with some funding. when the funding is put there to help these organizations, you'll find a great avenue to be able to supply jobs to these young people that many would tell you that lack of education and lack of jobs is what gives rise to the crime and violence. So one of the things that we have to understand is that you have to most certainly have the cooperation with those in the law enforcement community, but at the same time, having this closeness to law enforcement can also be a kiss of death. Our people don't respect the police and they hate the police. We have just experienced something in Chicago and also in Houston, Texas, and it's very important that we're very clear. See, the police cannot solve the problem of crime and violence because it's a social problem, and they're not social workers.
Yes, sir.
So they have not gained the respect of the community because in most cases in major communities, the police have brutalized and abused the citizens. Now, of course, that's not all police. There are some good people, men and women in law enforcement. However, we must first have a mutual respect with law enforcement in order for us to have a partnership with them. One of the things about the peacekeepers is very important. I'm very conscious about lining myself up with the police department, especially when I go into other communities. The first thing I have to do is see what kind of relationship that police department has with that community. If they have a relationship, a lot of police assaults and excessive force, a lot of racial profiling, a lot of unjustified shootings, then I've worked very hard to not to establish myself with the law enforcement community until there's a mutual respect made. However, in Chicago, Minister Farrakhan has been going into the worst parts of the Chicago. He was on the west side for 3 weeks straight. He went into the west side of Chicago. Now, the law enforcement community went in with the minister as a somewhat escorting him and trying to just, you know, help with the traffic and crowd control. But when they went into the west side, there were those in the law enforcement community who could never have went into this particular neighborhood if they had not went with the minister. And when the minister left that community and they seen the love and the respect of all these brothers who's in the hood showing the minister, they doubled back and arrested some of these brothers that they've been looking for. But they used the nation to sneak into a community that normally wouldn't have let these police officers in. So now we are having a problem. Same way in Houston. The brothers went into a certain project in Houston, got the people were showing love. The brothers told the brothers in Houston, I'm coming back Sunday. They bring you to the mosque. They come back to that city, come back to that project. The brothers look at them all stern. They don't want to talk to the Muslim brothers. The brothers said, what's happening? As soon as you guys left, the police came in and started arresting us. So now we have law enforcement who don't want to be upstaged by the work that the nation is doing, so they figure they come in and show and get the people and arrest them and then say we're working with the Muslims. See, that's the devious stuff that makes us not want to work with law enforcement. So at the same time as we recognize the great models that is taking place, we have to be very, very clear that if we want to be able to be successful and ridding our community of crime and violence, we have to have a working partnership with the organizations. And in this working partnership we have with the organizations, we can only sustain this if the people of those communities is sincere about ridding their community of crime and violence. Crime and violence is not just gun violence. Gun violence is seen to be at the head of the list. But a lot of the other violence is domestic violence. A lot of the other violence it represents, like in London, England. We're in London, England. It's not a gun violence problem they have in London, England. The problem they have in London, England is stabbings because they have a very strict gun law. So we have to be really, really conscious about how we attack violence in our community and how we build partnerships in order to accomplish this goal. We need partnerships. That is very, very important.
Yes, sir. And you know, and I commend you on your work, Ms. B, in the community and, of course, the program that you're working with. But to me, and then this is just to be my personal opinion, you know, we have to be accountable for our own. And, you know, I think it's good when other people and agencies want to come in, but at some point, we have to be accountable for ourselves, and we have to produce for ourselves. So the community in which we dwell in, if we want peace and harmony and love and unity in that community, it takes the work of the residents in that community to bring that together, because law enforcement is not going to always be there. Public agencies are not going to always be there. But we as a people will always be there. And so when those people are gone, it would sadden me to think that, you know, that is the only way we can accomplish love, peace, and harmony amongst one another, is when we got the watchdogs watching us. And that's disturbing to think about it like that. But I know that sometimes some things need to take place, but we have a time now where it's critical that we really do for ourselves, and that we really take back our communities, and we really deal with our children and our problems and our own communities, because, as Brother Dennis said, the police doesn't always have the best intentions, and, you know, hats off to those that do. So I'm going to leave that where I left that. So,
okay, and I want to respond, if you don't mind. Again, my name is Miss B. I'm from Richmond, California. I grew up on the blocks that I walk on every Friday night. I was a part of the problem. I was a part of domestic violence. I was a part of robbery. I was a part of prostitution. I've lived the life that some of these young people are experiencing today. And as a direct result of the life I lived, they are where they are. I take full responsibility for my actions and behaviors, for the things that I did, and to rectify and hopefully save a life, save my children's lives. I get out every Friday in my community. Ceasefire in my city is based on community, full community participation, community voices at the table where the decisions are made. We're not about putting people in jail, but if I need some bag up, I'm calling the police, because they're the ones that hold a key to put someone someplace out of the way. If it means I can get one brother off the street from shooting 15 like they've been doing, because we got a handful of people that are doing the killings and the robberies and the burglaries that are threatening the high schools where I live at. It's just a handful of them. But my community is bigger than the gangs and the violence that have been taking place. We hold the power. We have to open our mouths and say, I see you, and I'm not going to allow you to keep doing this in front of my house, around the corner from my house, or down the street where my daughter has to go to school. We are the ceasefire. I'm ceasefire. I'm the interrupter. I'm the person that's going to say, I see you, I'm here. What can I do to help you to not pull that trigger, to not hit that sister again? It's not about the police for me. And I don't hate them or dislike them, but if I need them, I'm going to call them, because that's what they're here to do, serve me, protect and to serve me. And I know we have some corrupt ones out there, but I can't judge everybody based on a few people's actions, just like I can't judge every young brother or sister based on a few people's actions. I have to look for the good in them, because as a Christian, that's what I am to do, to look beyond their faults and find their needs. And we're going to have to address a lot of issues that are facing our communities that are governmental oppressors that have been around for years that are still oppressing. And fear-based organizations and groups of people who want to keep people away from the voting polls, and they're taking away their rights to vote, to move, to make changes. The oppression of keeping people in low-income, low-socioeconomic neighborhoods where you can't get to a job, because you have no transportation, and it's hard for you to go from one side of town to the other where the services are available. See, we have to break some barriers ourselves, and that's what we do in our ceasefire move. We're not walking with the police. The police are not on the block with us. We're not taking them anywhere. We're not giving information to the police to go arrest somebody. But I can go to the police and say, I need a list of the people on probation that we need to talk to, because they're holding that information. And when I talk to them, they're not telling me what these people are charged with, but they say, these are the ones we got on paper, these are the ones we're looking for, If there's something you can do to help change that person's mind, you go do it. And that's what we're about.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry if I gave the impression that I said the ceasefire is working with the police. No, that's not what I was saying. I have a great respect for the work the ceasefire model is doing. I have a great respect for the interrupters. All I'm saying is, we're part, every organization, from Man Up to Ceasefire to the Peacekeepers, mm-hmm. to us, Respect My Life, is part of the comprehensive plan. It's a big plan. Everybody plays a part to this mm-hmm. big plan. No one initiative has the total solution to this problem. But together, mm-hmm. we can solve it. And so that's what it's going to take. It's going to take many, many of these great initiatives working together. Again, the sad part, there are many great initiative grassroots organizations that's working every day to make sure that people are fed, people can go to the get medical attention, people can get their gas and electric bills paid. There are organizations that deal with HIV. There's organizations that deal with teenage pregnancy. There's organizations that deal with GED. There's organizations that deal with drug rehabilitation. There's organizations that deal with the reentry program. But many of these organizations, as you know, are not funded. So when mm-hmm. we talk about the great organization, they lack the funding to really solve the social problems in our community. The ceasefire model is probably about the only funding model that is really pretty much getting a lot of funding around the country. It is a model that deals with statistics and data. You deal with a lot of statistics and data, and I know the ceasefire model, most of the interrupters are in targeted areas. They have to stay in targeted areas in order for them to gather the information and to be able to model or to be able to measure the success of the fire of the gun violence that's in that community. However, the major problems that we have, you must remember, all bad neighborhoods was once good neighborhoods. My function as a peacekeeper is not to function on the worst neighborhoods. My function as a peacekeeper is to work on the good neighborhoods so they don't fall victims to the bad. That's why we have to work very hard together, so when the ceasefire goes into the worst neighborhoods, I want to work with the good neighborhoods so they won't have a place to run when you clean them out your community. Remember, I understand the street. Most of us came from the street. We recognize when we can't do drugs in this area or can't gangbang in this area, we'll find another area. So we got to plug up the hole for the rat to run into. So what happens most of the time, we will focus in the worst area. We will go in that community. It takes years, not just months, it takes years to eradicate violence and crime in that community. And when we do it, we run them somewhere. And then 9 times out of 10, they'll find another community that don't have that attention, and they set up shop. The peacekeepers work to strengthen the good neighborhoods so that when you do your work, they don't have a place to run, so we keep chasing the fire. So that's why it's so important that we sit down and have a plan. When I was over in London, England, they asked me over there, what is the black agenda? And it was sad for me because we don't have a black agenda. We don't have a comprehensive plan where we sit down with ceasefire, with the Nation of Islam, the Peacekeepers, Man Up, and all these other great initiatives and say, now listen, this is the part y'all play. Now y'all go in because y'all want to deal with the gun violence, y'all want to stop and get little Ray Ray or Tukey off the street with the guns. Do that, fine. You become the interrupters. But as you clean up this neighborhood, they can want to run somewhere. So I have to put a perimeter to make sure they don't run over this side of town that ain't got that problem. That's being smart. That's being wise. When the law enforcement community come into our communities with what they call a task force, they always have a plan. They never include the community in their plan. They never tell us what their plan is. They may recently just bring us in, but when they have a plan, they have a plan. And we know 9 times out of 10, we don't know what their plan is until they implement it. Well, we got to have a plan. And our plan, we have to know what our objective is, or don't nobody know what the interrupters is. They think, well, okay, it's a bunch of ex-cons, ex gangbangers, ex-shooters. They're getting paid by this organization to go out here. But when the funding comes, what are they going to do? Are they going to continue to do the work, or are they going to wait till the funding comes? But if the people don't know the great work and what it's all about, then we'll be like fighting for funds. Well, they ain't giving us no money. We've been doing this for, this is what they got us doing, fighting for little scraps. And I don't look for the city, don't look for the state, don't look for the government to fund our own agenda. We got enough entertainers, enough intellectuals, enough professional athletes and rich rappers that they can fund and buy all of the black community and make the community a decent place to live. So I think together we have to not talk at one another. We're going to have to talk to one another. So when I go into a city with the peacekeepers, I meet up with the ceasefire, the interruption, and I say, go ahead and do y'all's job, because y'all only limited in certain areas, because these are the targeted areas that they are paying for you to address. Now, that's not with every ceasefire in every city. But most of the ones in New York, I'm talking about Snug. I could tell you about Man Up. I could tell you about the organizations in Queens that are getting ceasefire money. They can only stay in a certain targeted area, where the peacekeeper is not limited to a targeted area. The whole city is our area. So if we say you in a targeted area, then that's cool. Then we make sure you understand that this is the area we put in the perimeter so that they're not going to be able to come in this side of town that don't have the violence. So then we're working together, and in working together, we can eradicate crime. We got to begin to start talking more about the great work each one of us is doing and complement that great work, not compete, complement. So I didn't want you, sister, to think that I was not complimenting what you're doing. I'm just, the thought came to my mind about the law, because I do sensitivity training with police departments. I train over 13 police departments. I know in California, man, the problems we the Muslims had with Los Angeles, California police, how they shot the brother in Oakland, how they killed. So we understand that they don't have a great we don't have a great respect. But however, you're absolutely right. When we're in trouble, who we gonna call? We're gonna call the police. At the same time, the police departments are frustrated because we have what you call a black wall of silence. And they said, this is their perception, black people don't snitch on one another. Now, I don't know where they got that from, because I know not only do black folks snitch on one another, but twice on Sunday. If anybody see 48 hours, you'll see them walking in with just a can of Coke, and they'll tell everything. Don't bring them a cigarette. So we understand, but at the same time, there is a certain code our young people live by. But they have a blue wall of silence among law enforcement. Police officers don't snitch on police officers. They don't hand in their criminals either. So here they say, we don't hand over our criminals. They don't hand over their criminals. But at the same time, I agree with you, sister. We got to stop this being silent, because like Martin Luther King says, when you see crime or you see violence and you don't speak to that violence, your silence is betrayal. We have to make our community believe, understand, that I am a civilized man. And as a civilized man, I cannot watch you commit an act of violence. And I keep my mouth shut. No, sir, no, ma'am. I will report you. But we have to be very careful who we report them to. We have to be very careful who we turn them over to. So we have to begin to start doing like you're doing. Meet our young people where they are. They're not in the churches. They're not in the mosques. They're not in these town hall meetings. They are on the corners. They are in these parks. They are in these in the projects. And that's where the peacekeepers, that's where the interrupters and the ceasefire, they meet our young people where they are. And that's the way we have to address it. So I didn't want you to thank my sister. I commend the work. I know the interrupters in Chicago. I know my sister. I love the documentary that was done. But I do know the challenges that the peace, that the ceasefire are meeting in other cities, and I do know the good, and I do know some of the areas they're working on to strengthen. But at the same time, we're all just a part of a big comprehensive plan. There are many organizations on this phone listening to us that are doing some great work. We have to work together to eradicate violence, because we could take the guns off the streets. But to take the guns out of a person's hand, this is what the young people said, and you probably hear this, so you know it better than me. The young people said, I would rather be caught with a gun
by the police than to be caught without a gun on the streets. Now, this is the mindset of our young people. Am I right, sister? Have you heard that?
Yes.
Because they're living in an environment that is dangerous, so you try to disarm me in a jungle. You try to disarm me in a violent environment. Don't disarm me until you make the environment safe. When you make it safe, then I give up my gun. So we got a big job. It's not a job we can accomplish, but we have to sit down in the room, put aside our egos, and get to the business at hand.
All right. Totally.
Okay. Thank y'all. Thank you both. DJ Black Seeds, I got some messages saying that they're trying to get in the chat room. I don't know if you have that open. Also, I text you a message because I need to know what's going on with this phone, because if my phone is up, I need to know what we're going to do. So I'll let you, girl, let me know something. Are you there, DJ Black Seeds?
You can't hear me?
I can hear you now.
The chat room is open. It's been open for a while now. And if the phone hangs up, I think we need to get Brother Jihad to take over until we call back into the show.
I'm right here, Sister Gidget.
Okay, thank you, beloved. Thank you so much. It's nothing like family. Okay, so, Brother Captain Dennis, you mentioned the agenda. And as you were talking about that, because I asked, you know, do we have a black and brown agenda? So when you talk about gathering the masses, so to speak, sitting down at the table, coming up with an agenda, is that feasible to do on a realistic basis? Is it something that you plan on doing in the future?
Well let me say this, Sister Gidget. It's no question it has to be done. You know, time and circumstances is forcing us to the table. Time and circumstances is forcing us to put aside all of our differences that kept us divided. We have been divided by race. We have been divided by social status. We have been divided by political status. And we doggone sure have been divided by religious status. Now, because killing and violence is so pervasive, we are not crying because it just happened to a Muslim. We're not crying because it just happened to a Christian. When you hear about a 2-year-old, 3-year-old baby dying by a senseless gun act, it has nothing to do with color. It has nothing to do with religion. Whether she was poor, whether she was rich, whether she was black, whether she was brown, white, or whatever color, we all feel the pain. And that's why we are being forced to the table to recognize that, man, if I don't help to put the fire out in your house, God forbid when a cinder is blown my direction, it starts the fire in my house. Yes, crime and violence is not limited to the black community, no more. We looked at the act of gun violence took place in Aurora, Colorado. That's gun violence. We looked at gun violence in the Columbine. We look at gun violence on the campus. Gun violence has no color no more. It has no racial boundaries no more. It has no religious boundaries no more. It has no political or social status no more. If we don't work together and sit in the room and come up with an agenda, how are we going to curb it? How are we going to fight it? We may not be able to stop killing altogether, because as long as people are not trying to do what's right, they're going to be killing. As long as people are not trying to get with God, there's going to be violence. But what we can do, we can create an environment of peace. We have to think like this, Sister Gidget. We have to think in terms of, now I commend any of our people who wants to go in and try to turn a bad neighborhood good. That's all right. But there has to come a time when the people in that community that you go, for example, we take the peacekeepers. We got the peacekeepers that have been consistent for 2 years in certain neighborhoods. I mean, these neighborhoods were crime-ridden neighborhoods. But the numbers of the peacekeepers had not increased.
Now, we have touched a little bit of the violence. The violence don't take place when the peacekeepers are present. Never have we had a situation where the peacekeepers are present do violence take place. Like my sister said, just the very presence is a deterrent. That's just like why the police officers, you've seen the police will park an empty police car on the highway and you running real fast. You see that car way up there, you slow down, right? Ain't nobody in the car. But it's a deterrent to slow you down. Well, if we are present for peace, it becomes a deterrent against violence. But however, when we leave, we can't be there 24/7. So when we leave, violence takes place. What is my point? My point is this. If the people of that community don't come and stand with the interrupters, stand with ceasefire, stand with the peacekeepers, stand with man up, stand with I love you. If the people of the community don't come and stand with us as we volunteer to come in their community and make it safe, then my attitude, I'm pulling the peacekeepers out. If you don't want to come and help us, I don't want to walk in your neighborhood and you sitting on the porch drinking a beer waving at us. Here come the brothers, here come the peacekeepers. Now get your drunk behind off the porch and get out here and make the community safe like we are. I don't live in your neighborhood, but I'm willing to sacrifice my time. The peacekeepers don't get paid to do what they do. These are volunteer men and women who are putting themselves in harm's way to make a community safe for you, and you don't get your lazy butt and join us. I'm pulling the peacekeepers out, and you know what we're going to do when we pull them out? We're going to contain you. We're going to make sure that the crime and violence in this neighborhood do not leave this neighborhood, and we're going to put a big old sign saying, into this community at your own risk. We have to get to that point. There's parts of your body that gets gangrene. When do you cut it off? When do you cut it off to save the whole body? The Bible says, if thy right eye offend thee, then pluck it out. Because damn it, it's better to go to heaven with one eye than to go to hell with two. We have to think like that now. If we can't save part of the community, you go in and they steal some shoes and they steal some, and they don't appreciate the work you do, pull yourself out, detain and make sure it don't leave that neighborhood and make the people in that community get into a community that's going to be safe and work with that community. That's my spirit now. I've been doing this for 20-something years. I'm looking at us. It seems like we're not trying to get better, some of us. And so now we have to sit down and talk about what is the agenda. We have to be very clear that when we come into that room, we leave our egos at the door. And let's put the people's interests above our own personal interests. When we can get rid of vanity and ego, and then we can sit down and talk about a comprehensive plan where we all are included and we respect what each one of us bring to the table, then that's the agenda. That's the agenda. And we will do that because God is forcing us to do that.
Can I jump in here?
Okay. I'm going to see if we have any questions. Do we have any questions, Caesar?
Hold on 1 second, ma'am. No, we don't.
Okay. I want to get to this issue with policy because at some point we have to make an impact on policy in order to create a change. And what I'm talking about in particular is the establishment of the criminal record for our juveniles. I don't know about all over the country, in some states, especially here in Texas, I'm a court advocate for juveniles, and the system is set up to a point to whereas things that we used to get into when we were in school, if we had a fight in school, you know, you might get suspended, you go to the principal's office, you might get sent home or whatever. They are now writing tickets and creating a criminal jacket for these youth. And over the years, between middle school to the end of high school, depending on how your jacket looks, determine on whether or not you're eligible for college, whether you're eligible for financial aid. So they're cutting these children's legs off before they even began. And I want to know about the impact on policy and how the system is actually dealing with our children, creating criminal records for them before their lives even begin. That puts an X on their back that leads them to criminal activity, which leads them to prison or to the graveyard. So, Brother Captain Dennis, if you would, can you speak to that issue?
I heard Sister B, I have another one of my comrades on the line who has just as much wealth of knowledge to add to much of this discussion. Last time I was by myself, and I always like to take opportunities to let other brilliant minds to ask the questions, because I have my way, but I'm just as anxious to hear some other people's thoughts on it as well. So I heard Sister B wanted to jump in. And if you don't mind, Sister G, I'm going to stick to that point, but can I defer it to my sister?
Absolutely.
Quickly, I just wanted to go back and just, yes, I'm here.
Okay, yes, ma'am.
And I wanted to just tell the brothers I really appreciate it, and the passion. I can hear it on the other end of this line right here. And in our ceasefire, we've also added on the end of that lifelines to healing, because a lot of us have been held captive in our communities, and we don't come out and participate. But what I do personally is I meet with individuals on a personal basis after those night walks and continue to engage. I believe that one of the things that we have stopped doing in our life is engaging people face-to-face, person-to-person. We do a lot of texting.
Right.
We do a lot of computerized work, but we don't reach out and touch people. So in the touch, you know, in psychology it talks about the child that has been nurtured by touch and the one who has not, and one thrives and the other dies. That's kind of what I feel we're looking at right now. We don't touch each other enough. With kind words, we're already judgmental when we walk in the door, because someone may not come off their porch. They have really good reason why they don't come off their porch. I wouldn't come off of mine a while back. But when I got with some other people who were like-minded and the fear dissipated, I was able to step out in my own neighborhood and do this walk now. And it really, I believe, for us goes back to being humanistic. We have to get back to being able to be sensitive to the needs of ourselves and others and reach out and touch somebody. Because we can talk. Until we get close enough so somebody can hear us, that those who have an ear hear, we got to circumcise and break down some of the stony hearts. And in line with the young people, this isn't something new that we're addressing. It may be more prevalent today, but these things have been going on with African-American male children for years, even along with mental health diagnoses or learning disabilities that they were diagnosed with. So these things that we're addressing aren't new, and as the Bible tells us, there's nothing new under the heavens.
Yes,
that's right, Sister. Just to add to what the sister said, Sister Gidget, answer your question about the X that is putting on our young people that seem to follow them throughout life, or the F, as we call it.
Mm.
You know, one of our great scholars used this term: you can never change your condition until you accept the truth of how you got in it. Mm. See, we like to run away from the reality of what created the problem, because once we talk about what created the problem, we may draw some old racial sentiments that we as a people like to always bury. We don't want to talk that. For some reason, we're the only people that don't want to talk about our past. The Jewish people will never not only forget their past, but they teach it constantly, and they remind us every day of it. But we're the only people, when we go to talk about our past and our post-racial history, that was back then. No. Remember what our scholars say: you can never change your condition until you accept the truth. Key word, truth, on how you got in it. That's like any good, if I was a man that was very extravagant in my spending, and then I hire me an accountant, in order for me to get some grips on what I'm doing and the mistakes I made, an accountant has to study
my past spending record. And it's studying the past spending record that he's able to show me where I must stop spending because I may be spending more than what I'm taking in. But it's the study of the past that he could correct the future. Well, we got to go back to the beginning. And we cannot ignore that we are living in an all-white, male-dominant society. We can act like that our young males are not being targeted. We can act like racial profiling is just a political ploy that some people use and they call it the race car. We can act like it don't exist. But the disproportionate numbers that is in the prisons of African-American males is unbelievable. The disproportionate numbers of black African-American males that are arrested is astronomical. The disproportionate numbers tells us either we're born criminals, or we live in a targeted racist society. Now, if that's the case, then we have to begin to start not allowing our young people to continue to be taught an education that does not include them in it at all. We have to begin to take ownership. This is what Mr. Elijah Muhammad said. If a people would not treat you right, will that same people teach you right? We keep looking for other people to raise our young folk. We're looking for other people to solve our young people's problem. The problem, as sister made a good point, they're putting a component. The component is the mental and social healing of a people that is sick, sick, sick. No one have ever did a study. There's only one sister, Dr. Joyce, who did a study. She got a book called, but it's a great book dealing with the mental abuse or the physical abuse of a people. In other words, if you deal with a person that has been sexually molested, and that person in their younger days has been sexually molested, they wind up being a victim of a great trauma. And in that great trauma, they sometimes hide it in the deepest part of their subconscious because you don't want to deal with the pain that just happened. And then what happens is, over a long, protracted period of time, it comes up in their everyday dealing. Whereas she talked about psychologists always go back to your beginning. That's where they find the problem at. That's where you find the problem is in the beginning. And so what we never did, nobody ever did a study on what the trauma of slavery have done to us. We have never went through a therapy session as a people. We never talk about it. But yet the residue of slavery keep popping up in our lives, the way we treat our women, the way we hate ourselves, the way we have no love and respect for ourselves and kind. But yet we don't want to talk about that part because it's painful. Why is it painful? Because when we really talk about it, it may want us to move away from the very people who have victimized us in this condition. We don't want to talk about it because it brings a pain. Well, however, when you talk about these young males, are they targeted? Yes. But at the same time, do we have a role to play in creating that condition? Yes, we do too. So we have to really come to the truth of what we can do and how we as black men lend to this. As a father, I have not been the best father to my children. I've been an absentee dad too. And I'm trying to make up from the things that I did as a young man because there wasn't a father to tell me how to be a man. So many of these young men don't have a father in their life to tell them how to be a man. So they're making mistakes. And I'm saying this to the women. 70% of the homes today are headed by a single parent, which is a female. Well, let me say this. When we were in slavery, the mama's job was to get us to survive the harsh slash of the daggone slave master. Her job was to get us to survive the hangman's noose. So she taught the young black male, never look master in the eye. Always bow, son. Always say, yes, sir. No, sir. She demasculated us. But her demasculating us was a survival tactic. And it worked. It got us through the most harshest period of
when you see the mama dressing the little boys with their pants down, buying them and say, this is my little man. It's the same emasculation when we begin to say, don't you stop me. Don't you stop rising up against the white. Get out all of that black thing. So mothers today are doing the same thing during slavery, trying to get the young males to survive a harsh history. But they're not surviving the last of the white man now. They're trying to teach them how to survive the last of another black male. They're trying to teach them how to escape the violent streets of the community. So the enemy has changed. The enemy is no longer Bo Connor. The enemy is not the attack dog. When Martin Luther King was fighting and said nonviolence, nonviolence, he wasn't talking about black folks' violence against black folks. He was telling us to be nonviolent to a people who's historically been violent to us, which was white people. Well, there's a new enemy now, I hate to say this. We have to teach nonviolence, not the nonviolence for black folks against white people, but nonviolence of black folks against black folks. He taught to love your enemy. He wasn't talking about to love your brother who was beating you in the head. He was teaching us to love white people who was our enemy. Now we got to reverse that. We got to teach black folks to love black folks. So 44 years later, we have flipped the script to talk about an era of how to be nonviolent and how to love one another. So we have to get back to the root. And the root is, yes, sister, there is a target. And you, when you privatized the jail system, when you made prison so that rich people can buy a prison, you have increased the numbers of men getting arrested because it is a business. It's an investing interest to keep us in jail, especially when you can't give us no jobs. So I believe if we want to solve this problem, we have to, again, sit in a room and not be afraid to talk about what created it. That's all I had to say. So I'm sorry if I'm getting so long with that one.
Amen.
That's okay, Brother Dennis. That's okay. Okay. So let's go back home for a minute, because you mentioned that 70%, and I actually did a study not too long ago. I think it's up to 85%, but don't
good
quote me.
God
on that,
Almighty.
Captain.
Whoa, damn, mercy.
85% of the households in black America are ran by a female, a woman.
Ooh, ooh.
And so, with that being said, I wanted to get back to the man and woman relationship. And, you know, of course, there are so many things we could factor in. We could factor in hip-hop music, whatever, whatever. But oftentimes, excuse me, there's an issue with the relationship that the man is not in the household for whatever reason. How can we make that better, Captain Dennis?
Oh, sister, you know, that is the $64 question. You know, I mean, you asked me. It's almost. Let me just bring a little humor into what I'm saying. There was a brother that told me this joke, and I think this joke is befitting to what you asked me. And the joke went like this: it was a man that wind up in hell, and he's saying to Satan, you know, I'm in the wrong place. And Satan said, you know what, son, they say that all the time. All of them say. He said, no. I ain't supposed to be in hell. I'm supposed to be in hell. He said, son, everybody says that. He said, no, really, I'm not supposed to be in hell. He said, I tell you what, I give everybody this test, and if you can pass it, then cool. If you can ask God a question that he can't answer, then you're out of here. So the man said, that's fair. The man comes back and he's packing his bags, and Satan looking at him, he said, where are you going? He said, you told me I asked about a question you can't answer. I'm out of here. He said, what question did you ask God he couldn't answer? I asked God, will black folks ever get it together? And he said, son, I don't know. And that's how he got it. You know. If God don't know, so you answer me a question, well, what is it going to take for, I'm like, sis, man, I don't know, no, but I'm going to give you my best shot at it. I'm going to give you my best shot at it, sister. You know,
let me make it clear, because I was kind of choking up there and I had to hurry up and ask the question. You know, there's a, I'm not going to say there's a particular particular reason. But when we look at the numbers, seriously look at the numbers, outside of prison, outside of death, there's a significant problem with the black man, black woman relationship. And we're not talking about the men who die or get killed. We're not talking about the men who go to prison. We're talking about the relationships that actually fail and a man is out of the home. So I want to be clear on that. And what do you think the problem is between the black man and the black woman? And then I'm going to tell you what I think it is.
Well, let me say this. I had a good opportunity to present a question to the Honorable Minister Farrakhan, who gave me some answers. And I'm going to share the answers that he gave me. And the question was dealing with authority. And the minister said to me, he said, son, there are five lines of authority. I said, yes, sir. He said, the first line of authority is man to God. He said, then the second line of authority is the woman to the man. He said, the third line of authority is the child to its parents. And he said, the fourth line of authority is the student to the teacher. And the fifth line of authority is the citizens to law enforcement. And then he said, if a man don't respect the authority of God, then women don't respect man's authority. And if the woman don't respect the man's authority, then the child don't respect hers. And if the child don't respect the woman's authority, there's no way you can go to school and respect the authority of a teacher when you don't respect the authority of your parents. And then he broke it down like this. So therefore, you wind up in the last person's hand, which is the police authority. So what I'm saying to you, sister, if we want to get this thing together, then man must begin to submit himself back to do the will of God. That is our strength. That is where you respect us. You respect the man who's striving to do good. You respect the man who's striving to put God at the head of his life. He may not be perfect, but he's a better candidate for you than a man who ain't trying to do that. You at least can somewhat trust him, not saying that he won't violate your trust, but you got a better chance if you was to choose a God-fearing man versus a man that don't have no faith and not striving to be right with God at all. Now, if we strive as men to be a perfect example of God and the perfect example that we have, the Christian's perfect example is Jesus Christ. The Muslim's perfect example is Muhammad. If we try to live the perfect example of those two men, then we win your favor. And as we win the women's favor to respect the man that respect God, then children are brought into harmony to do what's right when you have the man and woman striving. We have a break in that system. And any time a man is not present in the life of a woman, or a man's not present in the home, there's an imbalance. Matter of fact, the imbalance is almost, I like to say, she is a handicap. And when a woman don't have a man, she is a handicap. Now, there are people who are handicapped. That don't mean they can't function. I've seen people today who are handicapped who can swim with no legs. They could do many things. So that don't mean you can't function, but that means you are at a disadvantage. That's all that means. We're not saying that a single mother cannot raise a child. We're not saying that. She could function, but she's at a disadvantage. And when a man don't have a woman in his life, he's a handicap. That don't mean he can't function. That means he's at a disadvantage. Well, we have to look at one another that way. We have to look at, it takes two today. I know some women would say, listen, you don't need no man and you don't need no daddy. I'm the only damn daddy in your life. When it comes Father's Day, you buy me a gift. And then the man don't have no role in that child's life,
6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. And as soon as that young boy, 12, 13 years old, began to disrespect his mama, began to not listen to her, this is the first thing he said, but I'm going to send you to your no good daddy. You got to get out of here. He need to come and get you. Oh, now you want to give me to us. You didn't want him in our life. You didn't want us in his life when he was young and he was obeying you. But now you want to turn him over to us because he's not listening to you. Well, see, we have to understand that God has made each and every one of us play a certain role in the development of the child. The women may think that she's supposed to be the disciplinary in the home, but that's not true. My father was a disciplinary in the home, not my mama. My mother represented mercy. She was the one who was trying to pull pops up off of us when pops kind of lost it a little bit. When she seen us getting ready to get out behind toward my pop, she the one who kind of broke her and was the middle peacekeeper. But, you know, the reason why he didn't go to school today, shut up, woman. That boy, come here, boy. Dad, you know. But the bottom line, that's the way my pops was. You know, she was the merciful one. But the way it is now, the woman is the one that you know, is the disciplinary. The man plays no role. And if you look at our young men today, they're wearing their pants below their butts. They're showing their butts. Ask that young man, would you wear your pants like that in a prison? Heck no. You would never walk around. I remember to see my man, Lil Wayne, walking around on the stage then, and I'm trying to figure out, I know his pants going to fall down. One second. I just know these pants going to fall down. But when Lil Wayne went to jail, his pants wasn't showing, his butt wasn't showing. That man had his pants pulled all the way up to his neck because he knew that if you was to show your pants, show your butt, to show your butt, to show your butt in a prison system of men, then you are advertising our homosexual behavior. So we have got to say to our young men, man, I don't want to see your butt. What thought you want to put on my mind to see your drawers, your underwear, your butt? What are you saying? So we don't even know that it's a very sign of introducing homosexuality. Look at our men today. We're wearing not only one earring, we're wearing two earrings. We're wearing cologne that is called unisex cologne. Some of the underwear could be perceived as unisex underwear. I'm telling you, and we don't see what's going on. And then you got the mothers taking the work in the hair, braiding the hair like these are little, like my mama used to braid my sister's hair. That's how the mama's braiding her son's hair. I remember that. I only see my mama do my sister's like that. But now today, we don't say nothing. And so we are looking at an imbalance, and our children have no one to tell them. Our young men have no one to tell them what is acceptable behavior from unacceptable behavior. Who is saying to them young men on the corner, listen, my man, it's unacceptable for you to use the B word. If Kanye West has to tweet and ask his followers the question, is me using the B word right? If he don't know, if that man do not know what is acceptable behavior from unacceptable behavior to use the B word, you don't know. And these are who our young people are following. People who don't know, we're messed up. So we have to first come together. The church has to play a role. The mosque has to play a role. The nation is strong with the men. The church seems to be strong with the women. Well, if we can give to the church what makes the men, then maybe the church can give to us what makes the women. Maybe we need to do a dialogue. Why are the men in the nation strong versus the women in the church? There's no men in the church. Is there something in the Christianity teaching that make a man not want to be a Christian? It's what is it that the brothers in the nation, when they come in the nation, it transformed these men to be God-fearing men going into the community in the worst neighborhoods and protecting and respecting the woman? What is the teachings of Mr. Elijah Muhammad given that makes men like that? The church should be standing at our door asking that question because there ain't no men in the church. But if we never sit down and talk about this, if we let our egos get in the way, as the Muslims. You know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, a good Christian is a good Muslim, and a good Muslim is a good Christian.
We need to do that. And that's the only way we can balance this family, is that we got to start working together and have a healthy respect that the woman for the man and the man for the woman. But the man got to submit himself to the authority of God. And when he do that, then the head is being put back on the body, and then you see the whole body function properly. Now, that's my opinion. That's my opinion.
Okay, Miss D, are you still there?
I'm here. I am
okay,
here.
Okay, so let me hear your opinion.
You know, I'm going to agree with what he said from a personal perspective. I totally agree. There's a mosque right down the street from me, and I see those brothers down there. I'm like, wow. You know, but I go into my church, and there may be a handful of men there. But the men in my church, they're not really respected in our church because their voices, they don't stand on, I don't know how to put it without putting somebody down, but they're not standing in a man's position in the church because there are so many women there that are basically running our church. I totally agree. When we raise our children without a, I was a single mom, and I have my oldest child is a male, and that's what I'm telling him, to align your life with the Lord and seek him in the guidance of your life so that you can be a father to your children, because now he's a father. It's not for the mom to take responsibility to raise that child on her own. She didn't create that baby by herself. And to walk away and say, well, it's the mom's responsibility because she chose, but this was something you both did whether you chose or not. You have a responsibility there. And I had the same conversation with my daughter, who is a single mother now. And to keep them and to talk to them about being a parent and letting them know through my own experience how difficult it was for me. I'm a recently divorced woman, and because my husband did not have a reverence for the Lord, he didn't have a Godhead in his life, made my life a lot harder. And as he said, how could I show respect for someone and my children show respect for when he was doing the total opposite of what I was leading to? We were going two different directions, and the Bible talks about being unequally yoked. We were definitely unequally yoked. And I had been handicapped, not only in a relationship where the person was on a total different path, living their own life with their own will, but when they were in our home, it was a handicap to us. There was no life in our house. There was no order in our house. Everything was just unbalanced. The body was all over the place. There was no head. And a woman, for myself, I didn't want to be the authority in my household. I wanted that. They weren't. It just didn't happen that way. And I agree, when we have men that are following Christ, we'll follow him to the end.
Okay. Well, I don't know if I should say my opinion or not. But I am going to say that, you know, being a marriage counselor for over 20 years, what I have noticed, especially about us black, brown people, is that everything, when you really study it, goes back, as Brother Dennis mentioned earlier, to slavery.
Right.
And to understand that process and the effect on the psyche and how it has underdeveloped the women and how it has underdeveloped the man. So you have two dysfunctional entities coming together, and with all of that combined, it's like the blind leading the blind, and there's a certain entitlement that not just men and women, but as a whole, that we feel that we are due or that we are owed. And so a man, he knows in his nature that he is supposed to be the head of the household. But there's that feeling of entitlement. You know, is that, you know, I've been enslaved, I've been beaten, I've been a captive, and so I'm entitled to this, whether I work for it, earn it, deserve it or not. And then here comes a woman who says, hey, I've been just as much of a victim as Willie Lynch's slavery as you have, and I am also entitled. So there's a stubbornness there, and there's a lack of knowledge there, and there's a stain on the psyche of how we deal with one another and our past and how that past has affected us. So if we don't really understand that really we're not entitled to anything but the fruit of our works, we'll have a better understanding and a better way to communicate with one another. But there's that anger, there's that disheartening feeling that we have. And, you know, the man is beat up by society, the woman is beaten down by society. We have these frustrations, we have these crazy, unrealistic expectations of one another. And instead of coming together after being in the battlefield of society, coming home together, turning to God, Allah, Jesus, however you want to title them, instead of coming back to that, we come back to our own self-entitlement. And that's been a problem. And that's just something that I've picked up in my case studies, and I just want to put that out there. Okay, DJ Black Caesar, do we have any questions? I know we're in competition with Sister Ava tonight, but that's okay because they're going to listen at 10, 11, 12 o'clock tonight. Do we have any questions? DJ Teresa? Okay, maybe I lost him because he was on my phone.
No, I'm here. I had my phone on mute. I got a question from Pick Zero. Just go ahead and ask your question. Leave a comment, please. 609? Okay, Sister Gidget, go ahead.
Okay, so Brother Dennis, I mean, you're a black man, so this is for my sisters who have these relationship questions. So Brother Dennis, how does a woman deal with a frustrated black man after he's been beaten down by society?
Well,
oh, and has personal dissatisfactions.
You know, that is probably one of the most hardest things any woman can endure, is to have a black man that wants to be a man, but everything seems to get in his way or try to stop him. He wants to be able to provide for his family, but it's hard for him to get a job. He's already been convicted. He come out, he's trying to make a decent way of his life from the past mistakes that he made, but the record of felony, he gets punished twice, over and over and over. He's always serving that time. And she knows he's a good man by heart, but because he's facing this difficulty, she sees him slipping into the world of forgetfulness and into the world where of no return. And it must be frustrating. And it's more frustrating for that man. But I could say this. You know, we try to always seek God's help and to seek God's assistance under these most trying times. I don't think the sisters need to beat a man down in order to get him and to motivate him to do. I think that's the worst thing a woman could do, because you women do have a sharp-edged sword, which is y'all's tongue. And y'all always able to say to us the things that can catch us off guard, and 9 times out of 10 is the truth. We just don't know how to handle it sometimes. So we start and become and get into what we call the dentist practice. We just start going into your mouth. You know, so it's bad because now we got domestic abuse, and he don't know how to handle you because, you know, you shot with the tongue. And I know this for a fact.
and sometimes it does more damage than good when it comes to trying to motivate that man. It takes another man to motivate him. And the best you could do is be empathetic, but never be sympathetic. I'm going to say that again. The best you can do is be empathetic, but never be sympathetic. There's a difference between the two. Just understand where he's coming from. The hard thing about it, sisters, if you can be the fly on the wall, that if you have a husband and you have a man that goes to work, if you could be the fly on the wall to see how he acts at work. See, the first thing he do when he clock in, if you're working for the white man, he has to hand and clock in his testicles at the clock. I'm sorry to say it that way. But he has to,
yes,
he has to hand his test, he has to check his testicles in at the clock. And because he can't be a man. He can't be a man when the white man's the boss. So he has to suffer disrespect and indignities in order to keep his job. And the only time he can get his testicles back is when he clock out. So when he clock out, he comes home, so he's already upset and frustrated that he had to take this madness from this chump in order that he may be able to provide for you. And the worst thing to do is for you to complain when he comes home about something, so he's looking for a reason to knock something out, and you just standing there waiting to be that target. You don't understand what most of these men go through in order to maintain their job. And I mean, that's real. And that's why we have to be able to become a self-sufficient people. We have to get into the position to create jobs, because if a man cannot provide for his family, he already feels emasculated. He already feels that. So we have to be able to say, hey, we're working with some very unusual things. And, of course, you know, they would give our women a job before they give the brothers a job. So we're now beginning to have to address how, and he's the stay-at-home mom now. And we have to deal with that. We have to deal with that. But I believe our women have to be empathetic, and our women have to be very patient, and our women have to be very supportive. The Honorable Minister Farrakhan said the other day on the webcast, he said he thanked his wife, Mother Khadijah, for helping him to become a man. She could have destroyed his budding ego as he was developing himself into the man that he is today, but she was wise to be able to handle him. You women have to understand you can lend into assistance in helping to make that man. You can't make a man, but you can lend into the assistance in helping us to become the man that we are. You can beat us down and destroy him. Many of the brothers out there on the corner, 70% of the men are in jail. I guarantee you 70% of the men in jail are in jail because of a woman, either directly or indirectly. You play a heck of a role in our lives. The Honorable Minister Farrakhan said one time in his speech, he said, if we didn't know who God is, if we didn't know who God is and was, we will be found worshiping the woman. That's how powerful you are. If we didn't know who God was, we'd be worshiping you. So the bottom line is you play a very key role. And the motherly way you have in raising children, you can use that same motherly way and a psychological way to help your man get to where he has to be by encouraging. And when he gets to where he has to be, I hope that chump don't dump you and get him a white woman after you get him where he got to be. But I hope he will be mad enough. That's a heck of a thing, isn't it? You work with this bum all these years to get him where he's at, and he dump you and get him a white woman. You know, well, anyway, that's a whole nother subject.
Yeah, but
nevertheless,
he'll play the Dennis and put his mouth. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Did you turn to Dennis? And listen, you know, but if you do that, he should be able to turn around to you and thank you, honor you, and respect you, and put you in your proper place, which is above the nations of the world, for a rise no higher than this woman.
Hmm. Okay. Miss D.
Yeah.
We got a few minutes. Can I ask you that same question? How would you deal with a frustrated self-dissatisfied?
I really appreciate the brother. My son is standing here. My son is 33, and we had this conversation last night, and he had one quick question for the brother about the indirectly in jail because of a woman. And I want to say, because he's standing here, I want you to listen, because I do have a hand in him growing to manhood, and I do input into him positive. A lot of relationships, people are so damaged, and we can go back to where we started at with the violence and the oppression. Everything that we've endured from slavery on up until today has damaged us. When two damaged people come together, they just create more damage. So how can we be in healthy relationships when we're unwhole people? We're not even healthy enough for ourselves sometimes, let alone another human being. So, you know, we got single parents, single dads, we got people in prison and people out here doing all kind of things. But my son wanted to ask that one question of the brother, because I got him here listening as I continuously talk to him and try to input into him some compassion for himself and others as well.
Well, let me say this, that directly, indirectly is that every one of us men do things to please a woman. If we're trying to get a nice car, we're not trying to get a nice car so our fellas can look at us and say, hey, man, this is a sharp vehicle. And he jumps in. Well, it's all right that he's on the passenger side, but that ain't who you're trying to get on that passenger side. You want to get the girls to look at you and say, ooh, can I get a ride? We go, and this morning I got up and I put a little cologne on, and of course I took my wife to work, you know, and as she goes into work, I'm not trying to get a brother to say to me, oh, man, you smell good. If a black man say I'm smelling good, then I'm attracting the wrong species. I need to go home and put some skunk piss on, because I'm sure not trying to draw him. I'm trying to get that sister to say, oh, you smell so nice. I mean, everything we do is in. If a brother's in the prison, he's in the prison because maybe he tried to rob, he's tried to make himself a living, whether he's selling drugs. But all of it is motivated by winning the booty. The booty is the spoils of war, which is called the spoils of war, which is called the booty, is which men fight for, which has always been the woman. So everything we have done has been motivated to get the woman. So many of the things we have got incarcerated about is because our ultimate goal was to get to make some money. If I had to rob, knock somebody in the head, the ultimate goal was to get a nice outfit to go over there so I could be able to take care of my girl or get the honeys. So indirectly, everything we have been motivated by, some things have just been through rage and passion. But if we look at the core of it, somehow a woman played a role. And so we have to be able to understand she plays a big part in our life. There was a rapper that one of the record producers said that if all the rappers' goal is that to become rappers is to get a big car, get all the bling bling, but everything they do is to get a woman. And so they said, well, then we don't even have to give them the money, because the money allows them to get the nice cars. The money allows them to get the beautiful, get the clothes and the bling bling. But heck, if the ultimate goal is to get the woman, then what we do, just bypass all that and give you all the women you want. So he could be in a pair of raggedy drawers and not want no money if the ultimate goal is the woman. And that's the truth. So we got to understand, when I said indirectly, is that if you look at some of the problems that we have as men, or why we are in the situation we're in, I tell you, if we look at it, a woman is at the root of it. That's what I mean.
That was real.
Okay.
That was real talk. I've been on the corners, and I've been there before, and it was really like, it might not have been that was our goal at first, but in reality, the rims, the cars, the music, it wasn't for your partners, it was for a woman. you know.
That's right.
When you get dressed to hit clubs and you got to look sharp, it ain't for no losers for a woman. So I just wanted to hear your answer for it, you know, because I kind of tell my homeboys the same thing. We all grinding to make sure we look good for a woman. We work hard.
That's right.
We do stuff to make sure you get that good trophy on your arm. And that's true. But, you know, some trophies ain't always good to, you know, do that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, I understand what you say, like, we, you know, like a lot of people do stuff for women, but then some people, I'm not going to say 70%, but I'm going to say about 50. The other 50 do it just to make sure they can take care of their mom or their family, but it's a woman when it boils down to it. So you're right. He's right.
Sunni said mom. Sunni said mom here in the kitchen. Said, damn, he right.
Okay, this is my last question for the night. Brother Captain Dennis, you mentioned this earlier, Ms. D. I don't know if you've had this problem, but I'm pretty sure probably in the beginning you have. I want to talk about how we're dealing, how do we deal with the opposition in the community and in the streets. Because I know we're dealing with some opposition out there, and Brother Captain Dennis, can you enlighten us? How do we deal with that? You know, when we, you know, in the nation, you know, they hear us, you know, they see us, and they say, well, you know, y'all calling the laws on brothers or whatever. How do we actually deal with that properly?
Well, you know, one of the things, we deal with opposition with unity. Our unity eliminates opposition. If we just come together as a people, man, we won't have no opposition. The greatest opposition is our we are our greatest enemy. Jealousy and envy. If we can rid ourselves of jealousy and envy and start loving and respecting one another, I guarantee you we won't have no opposition. And the opposition we would have would be so small that we wouldn't even know it existed. That's all I have to say, sis.
All right, Ms. D. Ms. D, are you there? Okay.
Look, she's turned her phone off mute. I think she has her phone muted out because I'm looking at her right now.
Hello?
Okay, Ms. D, is your phone on mute?
It was.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, you know, have you ever experienced, and if you have, how did you deal with opposition of your, you know, of what you're trying to do in the street?
The only opposition I got was from a community and some of the young men that were there and just were disagreeable with us coming and just bringing them that message that we didn't want to see them. Basically, that's what it was. We didn't want to see them die. We wanted them to be alive and free. They didn't believe it. They didn't want to hear it. They thought we should just get off the streets and leave them alone.
And so how did you deal with that?
I kept going back. I keep going back. I'm a really persistent woman, and I'm not really afraid of being at the places I go. Because like I said, sometimes it's right outside my front door. And I just have to say something. I just continue to show up. And I have a son, and I have daughters, and I want to see them be able to live. And I've had to explain to them why I go out there every weekend and walk the streets at night. What I'm doing out there, and the purpose for me doing is to provide a way for my grandchildren to be safe.
Yes, ma'am. Okay,
and my son is back here.
You're at it. Go ahead.
My son is back here talking.
Okay, go ahead and tell us how we can get in touch with you, or if anyone is interested in joining your program. Give us your, you know, your website, your contact information, name of your organization.
My email address is Dewanda, DEWANDA, the numeral 1@hotmail.com. And we're not an organization. We're not a social service agency. We're just a bunch of people in the neighborhood that got together with Cisco that helped us to organize and empower ourselves our own selves. This is just my next door neighbors and people down the street. We don't get a paycheck or anything. We go out and just share the love that we have for our community with the people that are out there doing harm to the community.
Yes, ma'am.
Sister Gidget, Miss B, you had a question earlier. Your son had a question you want to ask?
Did you have another question you want to ask, son?
Yeah.
He likes talking to the brother over there.
Well, we're about out of time, but if he wants to continue to talk with Brother Captain Dennis, give us your information so the young man can reach out to you and talk further with you.
I would love to talk to my brother. Listen, my information is, everybody know I'm the founder of the Peacekeepers. We have 19 chapters, and we're in one country, London, England. And you can go to the website, is thepeacekeepers.org, thepeacekeepers.org, thepeacekeepers.org. And you can email me at my email address. It's Enota Project. It is spelled Enota Project, Project, at AOL.com. Or you can get me on Facebook under Dennis Muhammad, or Twitter at Captain Muhammad, CaptMuhammad. And I would love for brother to hit me up either on Facebook or hit me up on my email address and call me, and we could talk about it, because I love to come to Richmond, California, and start a Peacekeeper chapter, because our sister's already a Peacekeeper, and I love the fact that you're already out there volunteering your time to try to bring some sense of civility to your community. And I tip my hat off to you, Ms. B. Keep doing the great work you're doing, and I hope one day to be able to join you in your community to be present for peace.
Okay. We down to the last 90 seconds or less. Ms. D, thank you so much, and thank you, Everett Webb. I know you've probably gone to bed, but thank you for hooking me up with Ms. D. It's been a pleasure. We've been talking for back and forth for about a week or so, or 2 weeks, and I'm glad I finally got you on. Brother Captain Dennis, it has been a pleasure once again, and I really appreciate you and everything that you come on and do, and everything that you're doing in the community. May Allah continue to bless you in your efforts, as well as you, Ms. D, and to your son. Hang in there, brother. Get with Brother Dennis. He can help you immensely in whatever your endeavors are. Thank you, DJ Black Caesar. Thank you, Nation Building Family. Thank you, Brother Jahar, for being on standby in case my phone acted a fool. That's my brother. He's quiet tonight, but he has a lot to say most of the time. But thank you for your love and support. And I'm going to leave you all as I came. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam,
sister. Brother Dennis, wonderful job, brother. Wonderful job.